New worlds, new ideas, and new people. Years of entertaining conversation, stimulating information. Join the Celebration 25 with
Bill Jenkins.
Saturday night in Los Angeles, and welcome aboard. I'm Bill Jenkins. This is Open Mind, and we certainly want you to have one tonight. We want to stretch your open mind, and I'm sitting here looking at a bunch of photographs that are stretching mine. So come on in. Let's get it stretched together on this Saturday night. My guest is a man who has certainly established himself as an author, a researcher, it's created a lot of disturbance here, yon, and everywhere, considering the material he works with, the Philadelphia Experience, the Experiment, helped write that incredible book, which is still having a little shockwaves that go here and yonder as we begin to understand more about that science. The Roswell incident, the story of the crash of a flying saucer and back in 1948 near Roswell Air Force Base in New Mexico, Mr. Bill Moore. Bill, welcome to Open Mind.
Bill, it's a pleasure to be back.
All of these photographs. Too bad this isn't television. This is
Isn't this color radio?
No, this is color radio. That goes back many, many, many years. But we're looking at some brand new pictures of some old friends, the UFOs. The UFOs are still with us, are they not?
They are very much still with us, yes, they are.
What's happening new and exciting in the world of the UFO?
Well, something new, something old, something borrowed, something blue, as in book.
Uh-huh.
You'll excuse the pun. Lots of things happening, but tonight, we're going to tease a little bit here, we have an exclusive, first time broadcast anywhere on the air, a very significant new development in the field.
In the field of UFOs?
In the field of UFOs.
Something new has happened.
There has been the release of, let's put it this way. The federal government has always maintained that all of their files on UFOs are on deposit in the federal or the National Archives in Washington, D.C., in connection with the old Project Blue Book files. Bill, that just isn't so.
Is that 1717 H Street?
Oh, well, no, I don't think it is, actually. I think it's on Independence Avenue. But they have also never released in the U.S. any document pertaining to UFOs classified higher than secret, with the exception of the National Security Agency memorandum to the court, which is sort of a peripheral document. It doesn't deal directly with UFOs. That was released back in 1982. And that was 80% censored.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we now have a top secret document.
That has
and
not been
it was
censored.
Not part of Project Blue Book, and it has not been censored, and it has just been released.
And we will go into that in detail.
We will go into it in detail.
Now,
later.
We'll do it later. We'll do it right after the 11 o'clock hour. And the reason I want to do that after the 11 o'clock hour is not to play the old game to tease you and stay with me for the next couple of hours. This show is unique in that it is during that hour that we have our largest audience. And I wanted to share this information with you with the largest number of people. Although I'm sitting on pins and needles to find out what it is, because you told me you weren't going to tell me until...
No, you know absolutely nothing about this. It's going to be a surprise to you, too.
Okay. So our subject is flying saucers. Is there a new book coming from your prolific pen of any kind?
There will be a new book, I hope, before the year is out.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, possibly two of them.
Have you seen any great new levels of information coming in? More sightings? Are we in or out of a flap? Or is the flap coming from Washington, where they seem to be recanting just a little bit?
Well, the Washington flaps all the time, you know, mm-hmm. and the feathers fly over there, and the fur flies occasionally. There have been more sightings of late. And the last several years, you know, we've been in the pits. But this past year, actually since last fall, things have picked up a bit. And I don't know whether we're in the beginning of a flap or not, but I certainly hope so. It's about time something happened.
Where is this occurring? Is it in the United States?
Oh, yeah. in the U.S.
Southern California?
There have been a few sightings in Southern California. There have been quite a number that I'm aware of significant sightings in New Mexico.
Mm.
Again, it's almost shades of the 40s. It's where it all began.
What is it about New Mexico they seem to love? You know, that's kind of a desolate place.
I don't know.
Except for the missile testing facility in Armageddon.
Well, there's all kinds of things going on over there. You know, if you take a look at the activity, both the military and military research-wise, mm-hmm. in New Mexico, it's a hotbed of activity right now. Kirtland Air Force Base, for example, is host to no less than, believe this or not, but it's true, 168 independent agencies are operating projects out of Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque.
What kind of agencies?
All kinds of agencies, from the Sandia Research Lab to a variety of Air Force activities to even Navy projects over there involving high-energy lasers to space applications of all kinds, and considerable, at the risk of ruffling a feather or two here, I'm going to say this anyway, considerable administrative activity which has its action arm in the test areas of the Nevada test site,
mm-hmm.
In connection with all kinds of classified defense and aircraft work over there. But the headquarters is at Kirtland for a lot of those projects. Then, of course, there's White Sands and Holloman Air Force Base, and there's Clovis and the air base over there. And
that is where the first atomic bomb was fired.
At outside of Alamogordo, that's right, mm-hmm. in Trinity site.
So there's really a lot of interesting thing that goes on in New Mexico outside of its geography.
That's true. And then again, there's Los Alamos, which is a very active and ongoing uh-huh. scientific community up there with all sorts of classified things going on there as well.
So there's a lot of reason that someone might be remotely interested in what we're doing.
Well, let's put it this way. If I were an alien and I were visiting planet Earth, I would certainly want to know what sort of rocks, spears, and arrows the aliens had, or the locals had, excuse me, that they might want to throw at me. And the way to find that out is to monitor the places where the locals are building those things.
If I were an alien visiting the planet Earth, I would have made sure I got hazardous duty pay before I came.
Or after you get back.
After you get back, if you made it back. I mean, if the people didn't get you, the atmosphere would.
Especially out here.
All right, you're on a Saturday night with Bill Jenkins and Open Mind. My guest is Bill Moore, author of the Roswell Incident. Certainly, if you have questions about that, you can. The Philadelphia Experiment, you had a hand in the ink that went on there. Other things. One of the leading researchers into the validity of the UFO. I don't think, Bill, you're interested in the flak. You're really interested in the hard data. The government cover-up and how they have covered it up. Bill knows more about that, I suppose, than anyone, and he'll be glad to share all of that information with you. And we're going to be here till midnight doing that, and you're going to get something brand new right after the 11 o'clock hour from Mr. Moore, and that ought to be quite interesting. So stay with, will you? And to answer questions you may have about the UFO, about the Philadelphia Experiment, about any of these things that he certainly has a great deal of expertise in, and rather than you and I chit-chatting along, I found out a long time ago, Bill, that the audience here is much smarter than I am, so I'm going to turn you over to them. Let me give you the numbers to talk to Bill tonight. They all end in talk, as you know. In Los Angeles, 520-TALK. Out in the San Fernando Valley, your number 990. Orange County, we want to talk to you. Your number is 750. If you're in Pasadena, Glendale, and Burbank, 244. The San Gabriel Valley, 448. Out in the South Bay, and that includes Palos Verdes, Rolling Hills, those areas, your number is 679. And if you're in Long Beach, San Pedro, Paramount, Downey, that area, your number is 639. They all end in talk, T-A-L-K. So it's your chance to kind of talk it up. And Don is on the line. Don, welcome aboard.
Hi, Bill. I just want to make a comment regarding the proliferation of sightings. It's always amazed me that even though we have a number of these sightings, that they never seem to make contact with government officials to announce their presence there. And I realize there may be a number of reasons for that, but It just seems that the fact that they just come here and do whatever they want, they're totally, it's totally unlawful for them to do that.
Well,
we already have a, what's that?
Whose law are you talking about?
Well, I mean, it's against our law, obviously, and it seems to me that, these people are, or whatever they are, they're just coming into our airspace.
I think that Milton Friedman had one of the best lines for that. Whenever you're in the forest, you don't particularly obey the law of the squirrels or even talk to them.
Yeah, I think that's true, but we already have, especially in California, we already have quite an illegal alien problem. But let me... But I did...
Are you writing some gag lines for Johnny Carson show?
I did want to ask your guest if he's heard of the book called Secret Intent.
With some reservation, let's call it Clear Intent.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't remember. Was that the name of it? Is it Clear Intent?
Clear Intent, yes. Okay. As a matter of fact, I carry it through my publication service.
All right. Well, what I wanted to ask you is I haven't heard very much promotion on the book. On ABC, I believe, must have been a couple months ago, I heard the author interviewed, and it sounded to me like a really fascinating book, and I just wondered if you had any comments as to the authenticity.
Well, I certainly can comment as to the authenticity of some of it because he borrowed it from me, so I know it's good stuff.
Yeah, the author's name was Larry Fawcett.
Larry Fawcett and Barry Greenwood are co-authors on it. I think Larry was on the air.
Yeah, he was. He spent 3 hours with us one night.
Yeah, I know both of them quite well. Larry, I guess, a little better than Barry. The book is an excellent book for research. It's a little dry in the reading, but then, you know, when you're going to read a lot of research, you don't necessarily have a plot. But certainly well worth the trouble, and one of the most significant books on the topic to come out in the last 10 years.
Yeah, I would say so.
Would have it in the library. Yeah, I have it along with the Roswell incident. You know,
absolutely. It's one of the top 10 books on my list of recommendations. Right after the Roswell incident and the Philadelphia Experiment, of course.
Right.
A little pun there. It is available through my publication service, and we'll give out an address later if anybody wants to write for a list of available things. We have about 100 items that we offer.
Good. Okay. Well, thanks very much.
Mm-hmm. All right, Don.
All right,
appreciate your interest in getting in there with us tonight. And Perry, welcome aboard.
Thank you. How are you tonight, gentlemen?
Sitting here.
Oh, good.
What's on your mind?
Well, I have some questions about the Philadelphia Experiment.
Came to the right place.
Good. I seem to remember when I was a kid hearing some strange things about that, but not knowing anything about it until the movie came out a few years ago.
You still don't know anything about it.
Still don't know anything about it. And I was very fortunate to tune in and catch you tonight. But wanted mainly to know, Bill Moore, what your sources were for the information in your book and how I could get a hold of your book.
Once again... The book is available in hardback through my publication service, and it's quite scarce in hardback nowadays because it's been 6 years, I guess, since it came out. It is available in paperback on bookshelves around town, if you can find it. I've seen it several places.
It used to be everywhere.
And it still is in print in paperback and available at places like the Bodai Tree, for example. It carries a lot of esoteric publications. They had about 8 or 10 of them the last time I was in there.
I never looked upon it as an esoteric publication.
No, but places that carry esoteric publications are likely to have it in stock today, whereas... the newsstands and the run-of-the-mill drugstore bookshelves and so on and so forth may not have it because it's just not something that is in the hot item category anymore, but it's still in print and still available.
I was also curious to know what your sources were for the material in the book, whether it was off of readings or interviews or whether you experienced it yourself.
Oh, no, I certainly didn't experience it myself. I think I was... about a month old or so when it happened.
Tiny little lad doing days of World War.
But we researched it for a considerable period of time and tried to get as close to the sources of the story as we could. And
you're dealing with some highly classified material there, by the way.
Well, I think it is, but not for the reason that a lot of people believe. The Philadelphia Experiment, for those that aren't familiar with it, we better fill them in here real quickly, has to do with an experiment conducted upon a ship, a destroyer escort ship, in 1943 in the middle of World War II, and it involved invisibility. Now, that's pretty fantastic, but there is a catch, and that is that the invisibility that they were trying to achieve was radar and not optical. And it was German radar at that, which was a pretty primitive thing in 1943. And it worked very nicely. As far as disappearing from a radar scope went, it did disappear from a radar scope. Where the problems came in was that they were utilizing a low-frequency pulsating electromagnetic field with the ship's hull as an antenna, long-wave type thing, in an effort to interfere with an incoming radar signal. Now, today it wouldn't work because we use microwave radar. It's a very sophisticated process. But in those days, it was a primitive thing and quite a different situation from a scientific point of view.
Instead of a stealth bomber that we're having to try to have
yeah,
a stealth ship.
Yeah, it was a stealth ship. That's exactly what it was. The effort was to develop a defense against the radar-guided torpedo, which it was felt the Germans were about to develop. Turned out they never did. We didn't need it. But anyway, the problem was that the men who were on board the ship, there were about 40 of them, were severely affected in the central nervous system by the nature of the electromagnetic field and experienced all sorts of bizarre effects, from just common dizziness and nausea all the way up to total blackouts, hallucinations, temporary blindness, and things of that nature. And even dream-type experiences in a couple of cases. Now, those men did not know what had happened to them. In fact, I don't think the scientific people knew what had happened either, because they hadn't planned on this. And it was from those experiences and the men talking about it later that the whole legend of the experiment grew up, involving the ship actually disappeared and turned up in Norfolk later and then back in Philadelphia again. And there was time travel and there was all sorts of things that go along with it. By the best evidence that we now have in trying to piece the thing together, there was no teleportation per se, except in the minds of some of the men who were too close to it. Now, that isn't to say that we haven't got a very exciting thing here, that there isn't a lot of classified material involved, because the implication here is one of, and it was realized after the war, and the research is still going on, it was one of mind control. If you can influence the mind of an individual by exposing him to a low-frequency field, then that certainly has a defense and offense potential in warfare. And, you get the ultimate scenario of the mad dictator in a white palace on the top of the hill pushing buttons and the people down in the courtyard being exposed to the field turning cartwheels, not knowing why.
See, we know a great deal more about that now, and you start resonating the human mind at the Earth frequency.
That is correct.
And then you start pulsing that resonance, which will run about a little over eight hertz. We see that happening in the United States. We see the famous woodpecker signals. We listened to them the other night. That is going on deliberately now from the Soviet Union, where these electromagnetic waves, which are very long and very powerful, are coursing right through your mind, and anything can happen to it. And perhaps that was one of the first times that we ever...
That's right. But keep in mind that in 1943, that sort of thing was not only unheard of, it was unthought of. And in the assessment of what had occurred during the course of the experiment, why, nobody really knew. Nobody understood.
I don't think anyone had ever pulsed anything at that low a frequency.
No, I don't believe they had. And so it was that that gave rise to the high level of classification afterwards. It was that that was researched afterwards with the context of what can we do with this. And it is still the subject of research. In fact, I spoke just less than 6 months ago with a scientist, a fairly eminent scientist, who confided in me that he was researching just exactly that sort of effect on rabbits and getting some rather shocking results.
Does that help you on your answer now?
Yeah, very much. I'm at least a lot clearer on what it was than I was before. I look forward to hearing the address for your publication service so I can send it for the book.
We'll certainly get that out, but I've got a couple of other addresses I have to get out of here. Appreciate you checking in. It's Open Mind. I'm Bill Jenkins.
Well, I've got a few questions here. I hope they'll be of interest to you people in your audience.
Okay.
Mr. Moore, you mentioned in your book a Dr. Vannevar Bush, who in 1943 appointed Albert Einstein to a committee, which could have had been related to the Philadelphia experiment. Now, in clear intent, it stated that Bush in 1950 was assigned to study UFO propulsion. Is this the same Vannevar Bush that you wrote about?
And it certainly is, yes.
Is he alive today, and what's he doing?
He's probably growing daisies. He died in 1974, I believe, at the ripe old age of near 90, I suppose.
Did you ever speak to him by any chance?
No, I never did. His son is still alive, but his son was never really privy to what his father was doing. Bush's papers, personal papers, are on file in a couple of locations, some of them at MIT and some of them at the Library of Congress Manuscript Division, and I've gone through those, but the vast majority of his classified papers are not available to the public at all. Bush was probably the most preeminent American scientist of the latter part of the 20th century, or the middle part of the 20th century, I guess would be more accurate, from the 30s through the 50s and probably into the early 60s. From the standpoint, I say preeminent American scientist, from the standpoint that he was a jack of all trades. He knew everybody. He was a tremendous organizer. He was able to tap virtually any scientific expert on the shoulder and say, we need your talents. He organized projects. He is, although it's not widely known, he is the father of the compartmentalization system that we now use in national security affairs, the need to know concept. In other words, information on a given project or a given operation is compartmentalized so that if you happen to be an electrician, all you know is what's necessary for you to do your job, and that's it. You don't know what the project's about. You don't know anything about results. You simply know that you're to go into a room and wire this to that, and when you've done it, that's the end of your job. He began that system.
A little while ago, you mentioned that the Philadelphia experiment's teletransportation from Philadelphia to Norfolk was apparently in the imagination of the people on the ship. Yet in your book, you state that it did indeed happen, and I wanted to make a point on that.
Oh, no, wait a minute.
Okay.
Where in my book do I state that it did indeed happen? I'd like you to quote that for me.
You know, I can't because I have the book in front of me, and it has, 200 pages in it, so I'd have to look through it.
You better read all of them, because it doesn't say that in there, except on the flap copy, which I didn't write. The publisher did.
Okay, I'm sorry, because what I was going to state was that if it was teletransported from Philadelphia to Norfolk, we'd obviously need a receiving station at Norfolk, and if they didn't anticipate optical, you know, or molecular dematerialization, they couldn't very well send a thing, you know, and have it received someplace.
So now, I don't know that I'd agree with that in any case. I know nothing about teleportation, do you?
No, I'm not a physicist.
Then how do you know that a receiving station would be necessary?
Well, because it would have to be transmitted in some sort of a waveform.
Now, wait a minute. You just said you knew nothing about teleportation. How do you know it would have to be transmitted in a waveform?
No, I'm just surmising.
Aha.
Okay, so let's pass on that subject.
Yeah,
I guess neither of us are qualified.
It would not be done in that fashion.
Now, let's not go so far as to say neither of us are qualified. Let's just go so far as to say that you're not qualified.
Okay.
And I don't know the answer.
You mentioned in your book a Dr. Reinhardt, the individual that...
Yes.
You did some interviewing with. Since he's dead, can you now tell us who he is?
I wish I could. Unfortunately, the family, which is still very much alive, has asked me to maintain the confidentiality on that, and I have seen fit to honor that.
Do they fear for their lives?
I don't think so. I think their main concern is that they want to live their life in peace. They don't want bothered by news media, interested researchers, publicity seekers, and just plain crackpots who would bother them in every hour of the day
and
night.
Go over all of his papers.
I have had access to some of his papers, as a matter of fact, but it seems that most anything that would have been pertinent he didn't have in his possession. That was all. That wasn't his property. It was government property.
Have you spoken with anybody who's in the government now that is doing any work insofar as invisibility, you know, for attempting to enhance the results of the Philadelphia experiment, perhaps on a smaller laboratory scale?
Well, now, first of all, the invisibility of the experiment was radar. Mm-hmm. And there's certainly plenty of that going on today with the electronics countermeasures research that we are experiencing, and you know, the public pronouncements on stealth are only the tip of the iceberg there.
Yeah, I meant in terms of the optical invisibility. It seems to me that when a scientist stumbles on an accident that big, the first thing they're going to say to themselves is, let's try to discover how we did this, even though we weren't trying for it.
Back up. There was no optical invisibility.
I thought that you said the ship disappeared.
No. It only disappeared off of a radar scope.
Oh. From reading a book, I certainly had the impression.
No, there were people who were there.
How about Allende? He claimed it disappeared.
Well, Allende is another case entirely. Certainly he did claim it disappeared. But Allende turns out not to have been there personally, but only to have picked the story up from someone who was. And is today, you'd get nothing out of him. He's mentally unbalanced. But the question here is that, or the problem here is, that the invisibility achieved was off of a very primitive radar scope, German radar scope, during World War II, which was much longer wave than what is being used now.
Mm-hmm. Can I interrupt this conversation for just a second, Jim?
Sure.
Because I don't want certain things to be invisible to your ears, or we really get jammed up. Now, can you hold on for just a second?
Sure.
We'll be back.
Co-author on that, of the Roswell incident, one of the foremost UFO investigators in the land. We're talking, I believe this is Jim. And we were talking, I'm going to wrap it up, about the Philadelphia experiment there, right?
That's right. I might add here that I have done quite recently, in fact, after the film came out. The film is strictly fiction. You know, it's a takeoff on the experiment.
It certainly had nothing to do with your book.
It was inspired by it. Let's leave it at that.
Okay.
And, if you've seen the film, there actually were two men on the ship who were so confused by the effects of the experiment that they jumped overboard and drowned before it was realized that they were in the water. And it's those two men that the film does a takeoff on, and instead of jumping off into the water, they jump off into time and find themselves in 1984 to try to get back. Interesting concept, but it didn't happen. But in conjunction with that, I have done an update paper, the first one since the appearance of the book in 1979, on the Philadelphia experiment, and it is available through my publication service. It's sort of a collection of material that has come to hand since the book was published, including, and we were talking about this off mic here a little bit ago, an article that I dug up in a 1930s publication involving a claim to invisibility, actual optical invisibility, complete with photographs of a device whereby a man steps into this telephone booth-like thing, and they turn on the field, and the person disappears from view. And there's a sequential series of photographs showing it. It's not written tongue-in-cheek, as far as I can tell. I've never been able to find anything else on the subject in print. It's sort of a fascinating little piece of whatever it's worth, and I tack that onto the end of the update paper just as a curiosity item. I don't know what to make of it.
Well, the things that would be in print on it right now, I would think, have super top secret and all of that written all over it, what country they're coming from.
As far as physics goes, it certainly is theoretically possible to create optical invisibility. If you've got enough energy to do it, you should be able to bend light the same way you can bend radar waves. It's only a matter of a higher frequency.
All right. Let's go to Bob, who is standing by. Bob?
Yes, good evening, both you, Bill. I'd like to start my little conversation with you guys tonight by saying in 1960 I had the occasion to set a little bumper dance in the Los Angeles, New York, and I flew to the West Coast. I got a job. I was doing very good for 6 months in Los Angeles, and John F. Kennedy was downtown, trying out for the presidency and running for it,
Mm-hmm.
So I went downtown that day. I wanted to see the Kennedy. I wanted to see Mr. Jack Kennedy. And they were throwing confetti out to the crowd, the trucks ahead of the time they throw it, the nominee.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was about a foot thick in places. And then, so there's this motorcycle. So finally the president, the ex-president, drives by with his wife, and several cars go by. Then there's this cop's motorcycle that caught on fire. So this Irishman was half drunk in the crowd, we should have let it burn out, happy, he was raising hell, Anyways,
What are you going for here, Bob?
I'm telling you about, if you just have the patience, you have patience. Well, if you're a typical American instant everything, then I'll hang up.
No, it's okay. We were talking about UFOs, the Philadelphia experiment.
Well, we'll get to that in time.
Okay, well...
If you want a quick summary...
Yeah, I need a quick summary.
Okay, then we'll bounce it around, okay?
All right.
Okay. I was in a mental hospital in the year Kennedy got assassinated, the night before, and I was sitting in my rocking chair. And they were singing my mother's song when she died. She wore blue velvet. And I was listening to the news on the television. Kennedy was going down to Texas next day. And I said to myself, he's going to die. He's going to die. He's going to get poisoned. So then, you know, I'm just rocking back and forth. The next day, in the afternoon, I don't know when it was, Walter Cronkite said, Fred has been shot. It's been confirmed he's been shot. And that started that. Then he took me out of that room, and I was in another room. The same night or the next night, Frank Sinatra's son gets kidnapped in Las Vegas. Then, several years later, I'm in Bellevue Hospital, and I'm Fifth Avenue's complex that I have, which is kind of personal business complex. I'm looking at the seagulls in the sky, and I think... I haven't psychic. Developed it. It's developed itself.
What is the stock market going to do tomorrow?
I'll tell you one thing. I like to know who killed Kennedy. That's what I like to know. I think
we should whitewash it.
You think we should whitewash it? Forget about it?
I'm not whitewashing it.
What are you afraid of? Yourself?
Hey, Bob, I tell you what. It sounds like you've developed or have a psychic ability that is precognitive, which is a little off what we were talking about tonight, although we didn't talk about that.
Good luck, you guys, anyway.
Okay.
Bravo.
Okay. Good luck to you. All right. I'm Bill Jenkins with Bill Moore.
Will it be the thing?
Saucers. We've been talking about the Roswell incident. We'll get into that in just a second. And we do have some lines open if you want to get in. In Los Angeles, 520-TALK. San Fernando Valley, 990-TALK. Out in Burbank, Glendale, and Pasadena, you're 244, just to give you a few. And on the line, we have Steve. Steve, welcome aboard.
Thank you, Bill. Bill?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, just wanted to say, first of all, I think you have a fantastic show that serves a real need, and I find it a meaningful thing to really look forward to hearing you every week.
Thank you very much.
Right. But I want to speak to Bill Moore about an incident I experienced in relationship to a former, I believe it was an interview that may have been done with Bill on television one time, about a year or so ago. I'll give you a real quick story of how it relates to that, and I wanted to see if Bill could comment on it. Bill?
Mm-hmm. He's here. I'm here.
Oh, I guess it was about 10 years ago I first had an age regression done by Marsha Moore and several different people over that period of time. And I went back and had this experience in an age regression. And in it, I reported what appeared to be, they asked me what I was wearing on my hands, and I couldn't describe it, but it turned out that these hands appeared to be something like claws, like these long, three flexible fingers.
I tell you what, we just had some flexible fingers reach in here. I've got to do one thing. I want you to hold that thought. I don't mean to break it up, but I've got to. But I'll be right back with you right after, okay?
Okay.
It's open mind. Steve, I want to tell you something. We have a few little chills running up and down our back. Are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Because we're going to break away in just about a minute. But you said that you, in a regression, you had a feeling that you had claws on your hands, right?
That's right. I had been regressed 3 times, and when you think of going backward, it's not as though you go back in time. For me, it seems like you go sideways. They're always into places that appear to be in the future or something like that.
You should see the picture that Bill produced out of the stack of documentation.
That's what I'm calling about, probably. That's what my call is about, and I want to see if there's a connection or relationship to it.
Well, we're looking at your hands.
In trying to describe these fingers or hands, this was 10 years ago, and it's one that you know one of the techniques they use. They ask you what you're wearing and so on, and I was trying to describe the hands, but I couldn't because they looked like three claws that were kind of long and flexible. But anyway...
Hear the music?
Yeah.
We want to get into this with you. I think it's going to be fascinating. Do you mind sitting by while we listen to the news?
Sure.
And we'll be right back to you, Steve. It's Open Mind, and my guest tonight is the author of The Roswell Incident, The Philadelphia Experiment, one of the leading UFO researchers in the country, Mr. Bill Moore. You stay with us. We have 2 more hours to go, and we'll try to stretch your mind on Open Mind.
Happy celebration, 25!
Years or so ago, I went through an age regression, so I've been through 2 or 3 of them, and every time I go through them, it doesn't seem like you go backwards as you think of in an age regression, but you seem to go into the future where you always wind up, I've always wound up in spaces that seem like the future. In this particular one that I was relating to, One of the techniques they use is to ask you what you're wearing and so on like that, and it's found that I was wearing gold Mamé boots and silver pants, and then they get to your hands and want to know what I was wearing, and there was my hands. I said I didn't have any hands that were like claws, and they were like three long, flexible claws. And years ago, then along comes E.T., and it's sort of like that, but the E.T. fingers had, weren't quite like you saw them on that movie series, but this was something a little bit different. But anyway, that was quite some time ago. But when I was in this structure that I had been regressed into, it appeared like you were in this kind of like a fuzzy egg inside, and it had a broad, long window looking out, and it had a computer panel all lighting up and with lights going blip, 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 blip. But anyway, the hand was the important and the interesting thing about it. And years later, I guess it was about a year or so ago, I was watching television, and someone was doing an interview, and I believe it was with you, Bill, discussing your Roswell incident, and they panned in on you on the interview, and when they got close in behind you, it had nothing to do with what they were interviewing, but here hanging on the wall behind you on this television interview was an exact duplicate of this hand that I had seen in my regression. And I'd always wondered how to get in touch with you, and I was quite excited this evening when I heard you were going to be on here. And I often wanted to call and say, what connection does that hand that was hanging on the wall in your office, does it have any connection to the Roswell incident? And I often wondered what it was, because it was almost exactly what I had seen in my regression.
Is that the hand we're looking at here?
That photograph, I don't know whether it was on mic there or not, so I better say it again. We're sitting here looking at just that photograph, and... it's the same one that was off the wall in my off the wall. You'll forgive the pun, in my office. When I moved, I took it down off the wall, and I haven't put it back up on the wall of the new place yet. But it is a drawing based on and slightly distorted, unfortunately, but based on a photograph that I have a copy of, which was leaked some years back. From a source who certainly had credentials within the government framework, but we have not been able to do anything beyond that with it. It just, it's a curiosity item, but there is no authentication as to just exactly whether it's the real thing or not.
Is there some question of whether that had anything to do with the Roswell incident?
Well, the curiosity is that in the Roswell incident, the aliens, the bodies of the aliens, were reported quite reliably to have four-fingered hands. That is, three fingers, which are somewhat claw-like, with a fourth one that overlaps the other three, so that there would be a grasping sort of a thing. If you can envision, with our color radio out there, we'll show you the picture of this. Take your own hand and take the three fingers, your index finger, the middle finger, and the ring finger, ignoring your little finger, and assume they are three fingers, and then a fourth finger, which is somewhat closer to them than your thumb is, but longer than your thumb, so that if you fold your three fingers over the palm of your hand, the fourth finger would then fold completely over the top of them. And that is the report that we're getting of an alien hand, that it's a four-fingered hand.
Well, that's very interesting, because with this experience that I've had and the regression had taken place 10 years ago before I even knew about the book and the Roswell incident.
Well, there was no such book in 10 years
that's
ago.
That's what I meant. I had never, it's so consequent, yeah. It was anything that it wasn't anything to have heard of before. But in this regression, it seems strange that every time I have a regression, the three times it's been done, I seem to wind up in these spaces that seem like their future, or you go back so far to maybe if there is such a thing as Atlantis.
Well, you stop and think about it. You know, evolutionally, what's the word I want here? Speaking in the terms of evolution, for lack of a better, there really isn't a whole lot of use for your little finger. And it's possible in terms of an evolutionary concept, that would eventually devolve into a vestige.
Pinkies would go out of style.
Yeah, it certainly would. One could not drink one's Demitasse in the style of the Epicurean manner, or whatever one wants to call it. But in any case, the photograph that came out and came through another researcher, was leaked to another researcher, was so reminiscent of the descriptions that I was getting of the alien hand that I saw fit to put it up on the wall. And that's what you saw. The program that you recall was Two on the Town on another network.
Is that what it was?
That's what it was.
It was about a year or so ago, as I recall.
Yeah, it ran about a year ago. It was actually filmed about 2 years ago, but it had a rerun about a year back.
So what you're saying then, as I understand it, is there's no real connection with that. It was a leaked photograph, but you really don't quite know what the connection was to the Roswell incident?
I wish I knew. I wish I could corroborate the whole thing through. But I'd be happy to send you a copy of the photograph. If you, again, we'll give an address out in a little bit, write to me and mention the conversation we've had here on the air, and I'll be glad to send you a side of it.
I would really like to do that.
Okay, Steve, does that help you?
It certainly does.
All right, thank you very much for checking in with us this evening. For those who don't know what the Roswell incident is, by the way, Bill, I suppose we need to update them very quickly.
Yeah, we've been talking about it here, and all these people are sitting out there saying, what? What's that?
What is that? Philadelphia Experiment, Roswell Incident.
The Roswell Incident, title of a book that came out a few years back, is the story of an investigation into the crash and retrieval or recovery of some sort of a craft in New Mexico in July of 1947. There is no doubt that something crashed out there. No doubt at all. The evidence that has come to hand in the past 7 years since we began the investigation, nearly 8 years now, is highly compelling, highly suggestive that the craft was an alien spaceship. There are over 90 individuals now who have given information, over 30 of them firsthand. A number of those people of considerable rank and reputation. There was a piece done just Thursday night, as a matter of fact, on the television KABC, which ran as part of it the interviews with several of the eyewitnesses to this thing. And there just is no doubt that something came down. If you go out there into the remote part of New Mexico where it occurred and talk to the locals, many of those families have lived out there for several generations, they talk quite openly about spaceship, the crash of the spaceship. To them, that's what it was.
And you're not going to convince them otherwise.
No. I mean, these are people that are stiff, conservative, upstanding, upright people who just aren't prone to imagination. And yet, as far as they're concerned, that event occurred out there. They remember it. Many of them do. And it was the spaceship. That's what they call it.
By the way, we should point out that they were next door to White Sands Proving Ground. They were used to rockets and seeing those go on.
Absolutely, they certainly were, and the government subsequently said, oh, wait a minute, we made a terrible mistake. They officially released a press release, a press statement, over the signature of then-Lieutenant Walter Haut, who's still living, to the effect that they had, in fact, recovered the wreckage of a flying disc. No doubt about it.
It even appeared in the Times, the Los Angeles Times.
Yes, it did. And in many newspapers around the world. We have quotes from the London Times, the Hong Kong newspapers and whatnot. The Army Air Force, then Army Air Force, stated they had recovered the wreckage of a flying disc. The next day, when General Ramey got a hold of it, he was commander of the 8th Air Force, on orders from the Pentagon, they said, whoops, we made a terrible mistake. It was nothing but the wreckage of a weather balloon.
On orders from Harry Truman.
Well, on somebody's orders. And Truman certainly knew about it because we went through the White House telephone logs for the time in question, and the only telephone call on record for the entire summer of 1947 between General Vandenberg's office and the White House and Truman, as a matter of fact, was on the date in question.
Isn't that amazing?
Which is highly suggestive that certainly that was the subject of the conversation. But in any case, the weather balloon explanation does not hold water. We get people like retired Brigadier General Thomas Jefferson Dubose, now in his 80s, who was at Fort Worth at the time, who was the adjutant to General Ramey. And Dubose says, without hesitation, that the whole weather balloon thing was a fabrication designed by Ramey to get the press off their backs.
So they had the press conference at Carswell Air Force Base.
That's right, at Fort Worth. And Ramey himself went before the press, and they actually brought in a real weather device, shredded it, put it on the floor of his office, and invited the press in to examine it, said, look, this is the wreckage we've recovered, which was just absolutely ridiculous, because the real wreckage was on its way at that point in an aircraft to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Where it stayed for a while. Then got moved
around. At least the pieces of it did. They had some more of it that was still in New Mexico, and I think it's still in New Mexico. I don't think it ever got out of there.
So now you know briefly what the
Roswell... That's the Roswell incident. Tremendous depth. In fact, it is the single UFO case, as far as I'm aware, that goes into as much depth as this one does. I mean, there just aren't other UFO cases in record that have that kind of depth to it of investigation.
Now, if you have questions about that, of course, we're speaking to the author of it, Bill Moore. And whatever your questions are, you're invited to get them into us tonight on Open Mind. We do have a few lines open. 639-TALK is your number if you're down in Long Beach, Downey, Compton, that area. If you're in the South Bay, 679. We'd like to hear from you tonight on Open Mind. Have you ever considered the possibility that Alan Body has created a workshop based on his own personal experiences to teach people the experience-expanding states of awareness, including the out-of-body state? The Gateway Weekend Workshop is a three-day workshop, and the next one will be given May 17th, 18th, and 19th. Robert Monroe has developed a patented process called HemiSync. It has been determined that certain audio pulse frequencies, when heard through stereo headphones, will create expanded states of awareness. This process is used in the Gateway Weekend Workshop. If you'd like more information, I suggest you give this number a call. Area code 213-393-9405. Monroe also offers a home study course of cassette tapes. To get more information on the Gateway Weekend Workshop or on the cassette tapes, call this number, 213-393-9405. Who were the extraterrestrials, the UFO, the government cover-up, the Philadelphia experiment, if you want to get on that. And Royce wanted to talk to us about those strange Martian pyramids. Hello, Royce.
Yeah, I have a friend at school, and he keeps telling me about these Martian canals, or what are they? Are they canals or pyramids?
Well, what most people have been talking about are a couple of NASA photographs that have been computer-enhanced by Don Molinar and Vincent DiPietro that clearly show what appears to be a face of a man looking straight up, which is an unusual natural formation. We see a lot of profiles of people's faces in nature, but looking at a face, looking at you like that would be, to the minds of many, if you were to look at the faces of Mount Rushmore, you'd say that was a natural formation. Right below that face is two pyramids. Oh, they are three-sided pyramids, so I guess it would still be pyramids. There are a lot of oddities about that. The angle of delineation between the pyramids and the face, and even the distance, is almost identical to the angle of the delineation between the two outside pyramids of Giza and the Sphinx. So that's what we were talking about there.
Yeah, do they think it's like was formed by a UFO or something like that?
Well, there are any number of ways to approach that situation. There certainly is what appears to be the outline of a human face that is staring back at you from the surface of Mars. There's no question about that.
Uh-huh.
There are certainly some kind of formations nearby which appear to be pyramidal in shape. And so one can interpret that along an entire spectrum from, on the one hand, the assumption that we are dealing with artifacts of an ancient Martian civilization, all the way to the other end of the spectrum, which would say that they're just coincidental natural formations, that they're not, there's no intelligence behind them at all, and any position you want to take in the middle of those two. There are some problems, and as far as I'm concerned, the issue is not yet resolved. I take no position on it at this point because I simply don't have enough data. The problem is that there are only two photographs of this particular formation that have been taken. Both of them, unfortunately, are at approximately the same time of day, and hence the shadow formation is somewhat similar.
But they are different.
They are different, yes. The other problem is that one can only learn so much from a photograph when you get to the limit of resolution. And that limit of resolution in the Martian photographs is not particularly favorable, unfortunately. Now, you can say, well, all right, you can run it through a computer, and the computer will enhance the photograph. But the computer will only do what you tell it to do. And that is sort of a connect-the-dots situation. You know, the old childhood exercise of connect the dots by number, and you do them all, and finally you end up with a rabbit or whatever.
We have to deal with a computer picture in the first place there, because
yeah.
we're electronic.
They're electronically transmitted, that's
that
true.
Sent to us.
But, so you tell the computer, all right, connect the dots. Take the dots in the photograph and connect them, and let's see what you get. And the computer does that, based upon the limit of resolution of the photographs in question. You get an enhanced face and an enhanced couple of things which look like pyramids.
Now, they use the Starburst Pictel system in doing that one, which is a pretty reliable system. It's a very good system.
Well, that's true, but it still is, you know, you're at the very limit of positive resolution, and so the issue is not going to be resolved
until we get some more pictures.
Until we get a better picture, until we have another Mars orbiter to take a picture or a landing or whatever.
But the enhancement of the photograph, it gets to be quite intriguing in that as they do enhance it, now, whether they're enhancing it correctly or not is a matter of conjecture.
Sure.
That you can see even the pupils of the eyes.
Yes, yes,
and,
that's true.
Tears going down the right side of the face.
The pyramids, now, on the other hand, if you... I can think of structures on Earth, natural structures on Earth, volcanic in origin, that from a distance resemble perfect pyramids.
Oh, you fly over Gold Mine, Nevada. There's a whole bunch
of
them.
Yeah, and I think your radio's up there. Turn your radio down because we're getting feedback here. In any case, the pictures are intriguing. They have been published in the newspaper a couple of months ago. And beyond that, I just don't know what to make of them. You pay your nickel and you make your decision on your own. Until we get some better pictures, there's just nothing else that can be said about them.
I had an interesting comment from Edwin Krupp, who heads the Griffith Observatory out here. He's seen the photographs, and he said, and he's one of the skeptics, by the way, in those photographs, you've got to remember the human mind also sees things it wants to see as it looks at those kind of pictures. And I remember the first time I showed that picture to my colleague here, Ira Fistel, he was quite convinced that that was a crater. So there is more work to be done on finding those Martian coordinates again and getting better photographs, but they are extremely compelling. At the moment, it doesn't look like to me that it was a natural formation. But are we going to say that UFOs made it or an ancient society?
Yeah, that's exactly where you're at. Without more data, you can speculate endlessly, and anywhere you want to go in the spectrum that I pointed out is exactly the situation. You know, take your pick.
The level of coincidence of the angle of delineation between the pyramids and the distance being almost identical to that at Giza is a little bit bizarre.
Well, I don't know that I'd go so far as to say bizarre, but I certainly would say interesting.
All right. Does that help you, Royce? Did that help you, Royce?
Yeah, it did.
Okay. Thank you very much for being here with us.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Good question, and it's one of the real puzzlers of the day. We're 27 minutes past 10 on a Saturday night. It's Open Mind. I'm Bill Jenkins, and with me is Bill Moore.
This is...
With me, one of the leading UFO researchers in the country. Delighted to have him aboard. Bill, I know that you do get out and speak from time to time. If I wanted to come see your material and talk to you firsthand, are there some opportunities to do so?
There certainly are, but you're going to have to do a little traveling. We may be speaking in the area come early fall. But for those of you that feel like traveling up to the San Francisco area at the end of the month, I am speaking at the National UFO Conference on May the 25th. That's, I believe, a Saturday evening at the John F. Kennedy High School auditorium. And that is at 39999 Blaco Road in Fremont, California, which is sort of the East Bay area of San Francisco. And... that will be an all-day affair, I guess, capped off in the evening by myself, and Cal Korf is another speaker. He's been one of the very skeptical people on the Meyer incident, among other things. And that is the, I forget what, 20-something or other, national conference that's being held, held every year in a different place. So again, May 25th, Saturday, 7:30 p.m., John F. Kennedy High School in Fremont, California. Then I'm speaking at the MUFON National Symposium in St. Louis. On that's being held on the weekend of June 28th through the 30th. This summer at the Chase Park Plaza Hotel in St. Louis, Missouri. And I can give you a phone number there. Anybody that wants to take a vacation and perhaps can get through St. Louis on that weekend, certainly you'll enjoy yourself there. Lots of speakers, all kinds of people. In fact, the list sounds like a who's who in ufology. Leonard Stringfield, George Fawcett, Bud Hopkins, who is into abductions, an extremely excellent researcher there, David Webb, John Schussler, Stan Friedman, Peter Gersten, Ted Phillips, etc., etc., etc. And again, that is in St. Louis, Missouri, June the 28th through the 30th, the MUFON Symposium. And if you want information on that, that you can call Helen Henke at area code 314-831-0413. I'll give that again. Helen Henke, area code 314-831-0413. The advanced registration through the 21st of June is $25 for all the sessions. There are four sessions, and that's $25 for all four, not each, or $7.50 each. And after the 21st of June, it goes up to $28, which really isn't that much different.
And the Chase is a very lovely hotel.
Yes, it certainly is. Chase Park Plaza Hotel in St. Louis, Missouri. Then I am speaking in Toronto, Canada, on July the 30th at the Toronto Public Library.
That's about right.
Yes, we want to plug a little bit here. The teaser is that we're going to do a first here tonight and break a news story that a new document, top secret document, has come out of the government. First time that a top secret document has ever been released on the topic of UFOs, with one exception, and that exception is really a peripheral document. This is a real top secret.
We talked about that one before.
Yes.
Eileen is standing by with an old question for a lot of people who get into the UFO thing. They want to know about Hangar 18. Is that right, Eileen? You're talking about the movie?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, that was a nice
it
movie.
It was very loosely.
It didn't have anything to do with Hangar 18.
Well, Hangar 18, I think, was inspired by the Roswell incident itself. It's strictly fiction.
Oh, right, I see. Also, I'd like to know, why was Project Wolfsbrook suddenly abandoned?
Suddenly? I don't think it was suddenly abandoned, but go ahead.
Well, I know it went on for 20 years, but it still seemed as if they reached a crescendo. They came to a conclusion that, well, perhaps we should just stop this project. There's no reason to continue on. Normally, when the public's interest heightens and the government's and the military's wane, I get very suspect that perhaps something is known that isn't being leaked out.
Well, Blue Book was terminated in 1969. It was begun in 1951, so it lasted 18 years. There were two projects previous to Blue Book, Project Sign from December of 1947 through about December of 1948, and Project Grudge from 48 through about the end of 1950. And then Blue Book took over from there. Now, as to why Blue Book was abandoned, it was really nothing more than a front office operation. If somebody inquired about UFOs, they pointed to Blue Book and said, here, go talk to these people. And Blue Book collected cases and whatnot and so forth. But there's a very interesting memo that was written in 1969 in October by General Carol Bolander. In fact, we call it the Bolander Memo, which dealt with the recommendation to terminate Project Blue Book. And Bolander, in two places in the memo, makes the very revealing comment, and I'll read it because I'm sitting here looking at it. He says, moreover, reports of unidentified flying objects which could affect national security are made in accordance with, and it lists a couple of obscure regulations, and are not part of the Blue Book system. That should answer your question.
Yes, I think it does. One more, the second part. Something crashed 1908, between 1905, 1908 in Russia.
The Tunguska Diva, as they call it, the Tunguskaya Diva.
Do you have any information as to whether anything was recovered from that, other than just finding some indication of radiation?
Well, I think there were some very unusual balls of glassy-like material that were picked out of the ground and out of some tree bark and so on.
Enormous destruction.
Tremendous destruction. Trees just all over the place. But then there was nothing in the area but trees anyway. There is a book on the subject called The Fire Came By. I think the author was Baxter. And that came out about 1975 or 76. You should be able to find it in the library. Used copies are available. I've seen them in several different places. If you would like a copy of that, I could recommend a used book service to you that carries those or can get them for you at a nominal price, $4, $5, $6, I guess they are now. But to try the library, I believe the author is Baxter, and the title of the book, in any case, is The Fire Came By, and an excellent study of the Tunguskaya Diva.
Okay, Eileen?
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. That's better. How do we get that?
Yes, we began last fall a nonprofit corporation called the Fair Witness Project. And the goal of the project is to pick a limited number of cases of unusual events, be they UFOs or psychic phenomena, whatever, and to investigate those particular cases to as great a depth as possible, and then to publish the results in as objective a manner as possible and let the chips fall where they may. The monthly newsletter of the project is called Focus. The other, for those of you without pencils. If you've got a pencil, the address is either William Moore or the Fair Witness Project Incorporated, 4219 West Olive Street, Suite 247, Burbank, California, 91505. And I'll repeat that, 4219 West Olive Street, Suite number 247, Burbank, California, 91505. Now, if you haven't got a pencil and you still want to get in touch with me, write to Bill Moore, Dewey, Arizona. That's easy to remember because it's like the Admiral. Admiral Dewey, Dewey, Arizona, and I'll get it. That's
the only one that lives there.
I don't live there anymore, but I have a box there yet, and I know the postmaster, and I still collect mail there. And my children live over in Arizona, so I get over there every couple of weeks. And that's easy to remember. Bill Moore, Dewey, Arizona. If you haven't got the pencil, I'll still get the letter.
Hey, what's happening over in England? Is that still happening?
The most exciting thing in England has been the investigation centered around the Rendlesham Forest case, or the Bentwaters Air Force Base case, depending upon what you want to call it. And that involves a landing close encounter case back in December of 1980. A very spectacular case, close encounter thing, military people involved, a lot of talk about it, even to the extent that there is some talk that the landing was sort of by invitation. The craft was in trouble, came down, got fixed, went back up. I don't know if that's true, but there's some talk about that.
And some of those papers have been released through Freedom of Information.
Yes, they have. There have been documents released through Freedom of Information, which clearly indicate something happened over there. There is also in this country, very hard to get book called Sky Crash, a British publication. By Dot Street and Jenny Randalls and one other gal who was investigator over there. And the Sky Crash is available through William Moore Publications at the address we just gave. I think the price is $14 plus a half a buck for postage, and that's about the only place I know of that you can get it in this country.
Is that about the...
That is the definitive book, the entire book, on the Rendlesham Forest or Bentwaters Air Force Base case of 1980. Brand new book, some illustrations in it and whatnot. Excellent book. I wish it was more available over here, but for some reason it is not. Title again is Sky Crash, And if you want a copy, drop me a note, and I'll send you a price list and whatnot, and you can get a copy of it.
Okay, let's go to Larry, who is ready to talk to us about UFOs. Larry, what's on your mind?
Hi, Bill. Well, I've been wondering for quite a while, like, the relationship between, like, the number and frequency of UFO reports, like, before the detonation of the atomic bomb in New Mexico, and also the subsequent detonations in, you know, Nagasaki and Hiroshima, if there was any information, you know, like before and after those events.
Good question. The modern era of UFOs is generally considered to have begun in the end of June of 1947, which would be roughly 2 years after the Alamogordo explosion of July of 1945. However, there were sightings throughout the summer of 1946, especially in Scandinavia, and there were a number of very unusual reports during World War II, beginning the latter part of 1942, in some significant number, and going on through 43 and throughout the end of the war, by military pilots, as it turns out, on both sides of the confrontation.
The Fuhrballs are the Foo Fighters.
Yes, the Foo Fighters. Foo Fighter, the word coming from the French feu, meaning fire, fireballs. The Germans called them Fuhrballs, which is fireballs. They would pace bombers, fighter craft, and whatnot on missions, so fly off of wingtips. They appeared to be able to outmaneuver the craft. And they were the subject of some concern during the war. We thought they might be German and were hence concerned. It turns out after the war we got to talking to German pilots. They saw them and thought they were ours.
There was only one known crash attributed to them, however.
The only one that I know of was some top of something had gone down off of Heligoland. I think that's the one you're talking
about.
This was
B-25. The Navigator Bombardier, I remember, was from Denver. The Foo Fighters did have a way of sapping your electrical energy, but they always let you get it back. But they weren't able to restart. It was a night bombing raid over the Rhine.
That may well be, and that's an incident I'm not familiar with. I thought you had meant the crash of a Foo Fighter, and there is some talk of one having gone down and been observed to fall in the area of Heligoland, which is an island, I guess, off the coast of Denmark, between Denmark and Germany there. But I don't know really very much about that case.
However, history is full of the appearance of the UFOs long before we had an attack.
Oh, yes. You can go all the way back to the Egyptians and find records of flying shields and flying balls of fire and gods in the heavens and even a bizarre case in the Middle Ages, in the, I forget what year, it's 900 and something or other, about an object that appeared over a church in Ireland and dropped an anchor which launched in the door of the church. Curious story. What do you make of it? It turns up in one of these medieval chronicles.
Mm-hmm. Has there been any kind of analysis done on, you know, any kind of, like, patterns of sightings, you know, in, through the 50s, through the, like, the atomic testing in the Pacific, and then, you know, like, when that was abandoned as a procedure, you know,
well,
since then?
I'm not aware of any known correlation between atomic testing and UFOs. There have been a lot of people talk about that, but I haven't seen any data which would suggest that there's a definite correlation between them. There have, however, been some very, very intriguing reports of the sightings by military people of UFOs, either before, during, or after a test. And in one case that I know of, a very good account of the pacing of the plane, which was to drop the bomb out over the Pacific, a hydrogen bomb test in the 60s, where two objects came in from nowhere, paced the bombing plane, almost to the point where they aborted the run because they didn't know what was going on. They tracked them from the radar picket ships on the ocean and took films of them. And I spoke to one of the men on board the ship who had actually taken some of these films, and he said that they just hushed that one up tighter than a drum, took all the films, and everybody was told, hey, you don't talk about this. And then the next day, They were told that they were prototypes of the SR-71, which is, you know, the Blackbird reconnaissance craft, a multi-Mach reconnaissance aircraft, which was then in the early stages of development. Well, I checked and found out that there were no flyable prototypes of the SR-71 on the date in question, and in fact were not for nearly a year thereafter. So they were not SR-71s, whatever they were.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for your response. It's really a fascinating program.
Okay, Larry, thank you very much for getting in there.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind.
Hi.
Bill Moore tonight, the author of The Philadelphia Experiment, The Roswell Incident, and we've been talking UFOs, and we have another hour of UFO talk to go with you right after the news, which is coming up next. Bill is going to give us a scoop, something that has never, ever been reported before.
First time on the air.
Something dramatic, you promise?
Top secret document.
A top secret document, which will shed a little more light on our old friend, the UFO. That's tonight on Open Mind. I'm Bill Jenkins. You stay with me. How long do we want to keep them waiting, Bill, on this document? Now, let's do it now. I don't even know what it is, but it's a heretofore classified document. We've picked up that much information from you.
That's true.
What? Where? Where's the document from? Tell us the story. I can't wait anymore.
All righty. This is an absolute first. This has never been broadcast on radio or television up to this point in time. And in order to build background, what I've got to do is go into a little bit of history here, because this is an oldie but a goodie. First of all, it has been the government's position, if you inquire about UFOs, that all government documents relating to UFOs are available to the public in the National Archives in the old Project Blue Book files, which comprise 92 reels of microfilm. We now have conclusive proof that that simply is not true. Secondly, we have conclusive proof that there was research into the subject of UFOs going on, which did not include the Blue Book or their predecessors, Sign and Grudge personnel. In addition, there has never been anything released with a classification level higher than secret. And the skeptics have always said, well, that's because there never was anything with a classification level higher than secret. Again, not true. We have a document now, which has just been released by the government, which was classified top secret in 1948.
Was this a Freedom of Information action that got the document, or did they just release it?
It was a Freedom of Information action, but it took some doing in order to find out where this stuff was. And I think it's the tip of the iceberg. I think there is more to come. Now, the document is an Air Intelligence Report, which was prepared in December of 1948 by the Directorate of Intelligence of the Air Force in coordination with the Office of Naval Intelligence. Now, here comes the Navy involved in UFOs. That's something
that
they've never said that they were involved. They've always denied it. Here they are. The title of the document is Analysis of Flying Object Incidents in the United States. And it was prepared by a group of individuals within the Air Intelligence Arm and the Naval Intelligence Arm who were designated to study a variety of reports that had come in. In fact, they cite 210 reports that they have looked at up through December of 1948. And they are assigned the study on the basis that they are to determine whether these objects might be of a domestic origin, some kind of secret project at a domestic level, somebody within the government doing something that nobody else knew about, whether they might be foreign in origin or whether they might be natural phenomena. And the conclusion is that they are not domestic. they are not foreign, and they are not natural. And so they recommend that whatever these things are, the further study should be initiated in order to assure the security of the country and the defense of the country. Now, keep in mind, the people who did the study were not privy to the Roswell information. They were simply assigned to study sighting reports that had come in up to that point in time. The other curious thing about the document is that there is an order attached to it stating that all published copies have been ordered destroyed. Somehow one wasn't. So what we have here, in a nutshell, is a document which is, or was, at the time, top secret, which did not involve any publicly known project, which did involve the Navy and the Air Intelligence Arm, which concluded that of 210 incidents looked at, the objects in question were not domestic in origin. There was no domestic project. Now, many, many people said, well, how do you know it just isn't some domestic project that, you know, we really have developed flying saucers back in the 40s or something like that and just aren't telling anybody? Well, here's a document which says, didn't happen. They are not foreign, and they are not natural. They carefully avoid any mention of extraterrestrial, but I'm not sure that they were assigned to do that. You know, I don't think that fell within their purview. One other very interesting aspect of this particular document is that in 1947, in early July of 1947, a Phoenix man by the name of Rhodes, William Rhodes, stepped out of his house, happened to look up in the sky, and here was this strange thing doing cartwheels in the sky. Ran back in, grabbed a camera, came back out, took two photographs. The photographs were published in the Phoenix newspaper and subsequently came to the attention of the federal authorities in the form of the FBI and the Air Intelligence, who visited Mr. Rhodes, interviewed him at great length, quote, borrowed, unquote, his photographs and the negatives, and he never saw them again. He inquired numerous times as to he'd like to have his photographs back, and he was told that they had been lost. The report subsequently showed up in the old Blue Book files as an auxiliary report of a UFO with the explanation in the Blue Book files that he had taken a picture of a piece of newspaper borne aloft by a high wind. Well, this top secret document from 1948 deals with the William Rhodes case. And curiously enough, original photographs are attached to the document made from Rhodes' original negatives, which the government told him were lost, and which they maintained for, 37 years had been lost. In fact, were classified top secret, are appended to this report. The photographs are in the report, and the conclusion is that they had done an analysis of them and determined that the object in the photograph was a real object and not an artifact of the film or the developing process, and they conclude that it was an unknown object. Now, there's something that they had hidden even from Mr. Rhodes for all that time and denied that they even had any knowledge of.
But they had to release that now.
It came out. And along with several other photographs in this report, which I've never seen, and a number of cases that are talked about in here that I've never heard of. So clearly, somebody at a high level within the military establishment was dealing with UFO cases as early as 1948, and certainly earlier, because there are cases in here from 46, not 47, 46. And it wasn't Project Sign, Project Grudge, Project Blue Book stuff. Somebody else was dealing with it.
And has been all along.
And apparently has been all along.
Hmm.
Now, I feel that we're dealing here with the tip of an iceberg, and that now we know where to look. There's going to be other documentation come out as well. They're going to have to release it because, in fact, I have a number of another Air Intelligence report, which was slightly earlier than this one, which dealt with the possibility that these things were extraterrestrial and concluded in the other report that they were. I have the number of the report we're now going after it. That's going to be fun if we can get that one out.
What do they say about this when you start coming up with this and pointing out what these documents are saying?
Well, they're very noncommittal about it. They say, well, it turned up in the archives. What can we say? And that's the end of it.
You've got a different group of people that are running the show now. Are they still of the same idea that the American people are so dumb that they cannot grasp the UFO concept?
Well, you back them into a corner. You know, you suddenly find a file and you get a number and you tell them where to look, and suddenly they have to produce it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're backed into a corner. They either deny it and then they get into trouble because maybe you've got more than they know you have. Or, I don't know. But I find it extremely significant that after all of this time and after all of these pronouncements that the Blue Book was the only government project in operation, that Blue Book did all the work, Blue Book this, Blue Book that, and that there was never anything secret, that we now have this kind of an indication that things were classified top secret, that the agencies involved were not the ones the public have been told were involved, and the conclusions that they're drawing are totally different in cases than what Blue Book is listing. You know, the Rhodes case, for example, where Blue Book says piece of newspaper flying in a high wind, where this report says definitely a real object, where they said the photos were lost.
They were found.
And here they are, classified top secret.
Well, they were lost in the top secret drawer someplace is where they were lost.
That's right. Now, the skeptics have always said that the reason that nothing top secret had ever come out was because there was nothing top secret.
Now, what do the skeptics say about this document?
I have yet to hear a skeptic comment on it, but I'm sure they'll come up with something. They always manage.
Oh, I know. You printed that yourself. You made it up.
I don't think so.
Well, thank you for breaking that story here. It is significant to those of us that have been following closely the government cover-up and the UFO story. I hope that that document that you have it there in front of you.
Yes, I'm sitting right here looking at it.
Gets widely circulated. It is a fascinating thing. And we'll be back to more about the reality of the UFO with Bill Moore on Open Mind. I'm Bill Jenkins. I had some pretty good information down that you've never heard before. Imagine a secret document, top secret document, admitting the government has been studying these UFOs and they are not natural. Domestic.
That's right.
Are foreign. Just not natural. How neat the way the bureaucrats talk. Okay, we have Mike on the line. Hello, Mike.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right.
Okay, I would like to know if you guys would like to get into the Pleiades. In other words...
It's kind of far away.
Well, that's the Seven Sisters. That's a Little Dipper.
Yeah, the Little Dipper.
Right. What do you want to know about the Pleiades?
Okay, what I'd like to know is, would you like to bring that into the issue?
Well, I don't know that there is an issue there. As far as I'm concerned, the whole case is a hoax.
I'm not so sure that it's a hoax. I think there's new information that is going to come forward here rather quickly.
See, the only thing I was thinking about was that we're talking about so many surface things, and I'd like to get into something a little bit deeper about the whole issue.
Well, if you have a specific question, I'll
try to do. I do. Yes. What do you think about ancient scientists getting down from the Pleiades and basically synthesizing human life or any kind of life forms upon what we call Mother Earth from that point? Is it feasible? Was it feasible?
I don't know. I certainly can't speculate on something that I have seen absolutely no evidence of.
You're basically working on facts.
Well, I think you have to work on evidence, and I don't see any evidence of anybody having come here from the Pleiades in any case, ancient or modern. The Pleiades are the wrong kinds of stars if you're going to talk about the possibility of evolving.
Right. I was alluded by the sign saying open mind, and I really believe in, you know, open thought behind that open mind.
I have no problem with that. I think that's fine. But in my own investigations, I prefer to deal with the evidence. And you certainly keep an open mind. If there is new evidence to come out in the Pleiades case, which would indicate that there is something to it, I certainly like to see it.
There has been a lot of mishandling of the Billy Meyer case, is the one you're talking about.
Yes.
There's a wealth of information there that I think we're going to see happen, get back into the mainstream where everybody can deal with it. Now, there's a gentleman by the name of George Green, not our George Green here at KABC, but who is a very fair and open-minded gentleman that is much more convinced about the validity of a lot of the things that Billy Meyer has said than he was when he went into it. And there will be more about it.
Well, I think that there is certainly something very metaphysical going on in respect to that case. There's a lot of material there that is of a metaphysical nature and is worthy of study from that point of view. But I'm not entirely sure that any of it has to do with UFOs per se.
No, okay. See, that's where I really...
There are now 40 witnesses, by the way.
Okay, please, if I can interject. What I feel is that if it is open mind, what I really feel is there a possibility that maybe scientists that were astronauts, that were thousands, maybe per se million years ago, came down to our sphere and was able to synthesize the highest form of life and then take off and then maybe come back at their own time zone, meaning very different time from what how we deal with time, and then see if their creation was inept and did exist.
Did you hear the show last week, Mike, by any chance?
Excuse me?
Did you hear the show last week by any chance?
No. See, the thing is, I'm very new to this whole show. Because the only reason, to tell you the truth, why I'm even listening to the show is because all the electricity is out, and I'm listening to you guys on... but you know what? It's one of the best things I've ever heard. I love it.
Where are you at that the electric's out?
Oh no. The thing is, I'm in a warehouse. See, I'm a musician myself.
I'm in a warehouse where
all the electrics is out, and so I'm just listening on batteries.
Well, I just wanted to support you here just for a second. Last week we had Drs. Lee and Vivian Gladden here, and they are anthropologists and etymologists which study the root meanings of words, and they have gone to an ancient artifact that tells us just exactly that story of a group of people who came here not from Pleiades, but from a planet that was in orbit around Arcturus, which is up there, one of our first magnitude stars, I believe it is, and did synthesize human life. Now, the artifact that they went to get this information was the Bible.
The Bible, yeah.
And their book is called Heirs of the Gods, and it's a fascinating thing to read.
Now, you know, that's great that you brought that up, because I caught this at the very beginning, and it was basically people calling in, and, you know, they were asking good questions, but to bring in something really relevant about
what are you going to do with it? Suppose, all right, let's take as a working hypothesis what you just said.
Yes.
So what?
Okay, well, what I'd like to know is this. Within your books and your context of knowledge, what would you think of maybe someone coming down, or some persons coming down, bringing down their technology, which is totally foreign to maybe even what we know right now, and synthesizing the intelligence of the highest life form on this earth, and then going away, and then maybe coming back down in a million years?
Yeah, I've got that part of it. But all right, so what?
I'm trying to point out to you that this lore has been going on for a long time.
Where does it go? What are you going to do
with it? It's in the ancient Sumerian writings. They talk about exactly that thing happening. Those writings go back for 5,000 years, by the way.
Yes.
So that's not
In other words, the way we perceive time and the way people from other parts of the world, you know, of this universe perceive time is very different. And it could be to them, it could be a couple of years to me, to you, it could be a million years.
Yeah, we understand that.
Well, okay. that's all
so
well
that's
and good.
I'm getting very confused because it said open mind, you know, and that's why I wanted to bring it a little bit heavier than what you guys have been doing so far.
Well, you should have been with us last week. We were doing just exactly that.
Yeah, I've got no problem with speculating about things like that.
I love
but ultimately... it comes down to the bottom line. Our bottom line is fine. Let's assume that it is so. So what?
But okay,
how does that change our present course of existence?
Well, it all depends on who wants to dream and who wants to wander in the reality of just what we're doing right now.
Well, I'll give you something to chew on, and we'll go back again to last week, according to the information that's in the Bible, that this armada is returning to Earth and before the end of the century from Arcturus.
And do you think that they feel that time is the same as we feel time is?
I'm sure that they've mastered that technology. Time is something that we create.
Well,
before.
You know, there is one fallacy that a lot of people fall into, and that is that you get question after question and thought pattern after thought pattern that say, well, all right, why doesn't an alien do this? Or suppose an alien does that, or what have you. There is absolutely no reason to assume that an alien culture evolving totally independently of our own, along whatever lines, should behave as a human would behave. And it's just ridiculous to assume that they would have the same sense of values, behavior patterns as we have.
Oh, I see.
I was
very deceived by you at the beginning, because I thought you were in the line of thought that humans are universal.
Oh, no.
So now what you're doing is you're separating humans from non-humans.
Well, I don't know where you got the idea that I thought humans were universal. I never said any such thing.
Okay, well, what I thought was
intelligent life in whatever form it may come.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, the old question about, well, why don't they make contact with us, which I think the first caller dealt with.
Oh, okay.
And that's not the right question. The right question from an alien point of view is, why would they want to make contact with us?
I wouldn't, I don't think.
And, you know, you can't answer that question unless you're an alien, because you don't know what motivates an alien. His sense of values, his sense of motivation, his drives, his desires, his wants, his needs are all totally different than that which we perceive as important to a human. And consequently, you cannot psych out an alien using human values.
We simply think the best thing for him to do would be land on the White House lawn. I would imagine that that's the worst thing he could do, because he'd immediately get shot out with everything we've got.
Yes, take me to your leader, but we don't have any leader. You know, we don't, not that Reagan isn't a leader, but there is no one who speaks for planet Earth.
I see.
And Reagan certainly doesn't even speak for 225 million Americans, much less even of the Earth.
No president ever does.
That's right. So, you know, we don't have anyone who is a spokesperson for planet Earth. We are, as Stan Friedman so aptly puts it so many times, in the eyes of an alien coming here and spending 10 minutes looking at planet Earth, we have to be regarded as a primitive culture whose major occupation is tribal warfare.
Ah, but within the context of noting that you are a primitive culture, the superior culture will have, let's say, if it is true, if they do have human bodies, will have the ability to accept and to judge.
I think they've judged.
How do you know that?
How do I know that?
Sure.
I speculate just as you speculate, because you do not know those.
But you're speculating using human values, and you can't do that with an alien, because you have no yardstick.
Okay, I see. That's where our difference lies. It's because you think that if there is intelligent life out there that are coming towards us and is crashing into this Earth, that they are not similar or akin to us.
No, I didn't say that at all. I didn't say that at all. I said that, first of all, I don't say if. I'm firmly convinced that there is alien life out there and that they are coming to planet Earth. Let's get that straight right off the top.
Okay.
Secondly, I do not know if what motivates them. You know, certainly they don't look like humans, and yet they do look like humans in a certain way. But as to trying to second-guess an alien using human yardsticks...
You represent a paradox to me.
I think we're going into a circle. We've gone over this
I agree with you.
Okay, Mike?
Okay, but the thing is, all I think is that it will happen, and that we will see that finally we are akin to those that are around us, not basically on our planet, but those who are around us.
Well, there's a lot of ancient data that says that that's what happened. And
I agree with you totally, and you agree with me.
Well, yeah. let me end it by saying I certainly hope you're right.
And I know I'm right.
Okay, Mike. Very good. And that's
just a little bit of what's going on. We have 25 minutes till midnight tonight. Tom Hall will be along after that. After the news, then, we're going to take a break, be right back with our callers, and we'll talk about New Mexico in just a second. Back to New Mexico. On a Saturday night, it's Open Mind. Bill Moore is with me, and we're talking to Don. Hello, Don.
Hi, Mr. Jenkins and Mr. Moore. I was wondering, since the Roswell incident occurred in New Mexico, Mr. Moore, have you ever discussed with Dr. Alec Tanuos the experience that he had in New Mexico?
I'm not even familiar with the name.
Okay, I believe that Bill can fill you in on who Alec Tanuos is. He was on his program.
No, he's never been on my show, that I recall.
Not with you, but he was with the psychiatrist. I can't remember his name.
Ah, he was on with David Miscott.
Correct.
Right, while I was in Fiji. I'm not familiar with Alex's work or what that was all about.
Oh, okay. Well, briefly, in Dr. Tanuos's book, Beyond Coincidence, he discusses an incident in New Mexico in 1972 in which he claims to have had contact with some strange creatures, as he refers to them. And this person that he met, or whatever, emanated a strange vibration. And the only other times that he has come into contact with such an energy form was when he met Charles Hickson and Betty Hill. And this is discussed in his book, Beyond Coincidence, and the chapter is Out of This World. And I just thought it was interesting because the local residents, he states, and I'm quoting from the article, he says, local residents said that the men had been there for years, ever since the first experimental atomic explosion at Alamogordo in 1945.
Local residents where?
Local residents in New Mexico. He does not state in the book which area of New Mexico.
Big place. Could be anywhere.
Yeah. But
I don't know what relevancy that has. You know, there are all kinds of single witness reports of encounters with aliens, abductions by aliens, close encounters of the third kind with UFOs, ad nauseum. And from my point of view as an investigator of these things, there is absolutely nothing I can do with a first hand single witness case. Unless there is some kind of corroboration of it, you have nothing but a single person saying, this is what I believe to be true. And it may be true, it may not be true, but what are you going to do with it?
Okay, the reason I mention it is because the credentials of Dr. Tanuos...
means nothing.
The credentials mean nothing?
No, unless there's some corroboration of the story, there's absolutely nothing you can do with a single witness story.
Okay.
It's like one person getting up in court and saying, I saw this man rob a bank.
Correct.
You know, and fine, all right, you believe that you saw this man rob a bank, but unless there is some additional evidence that the event in fact occurred and that person who is accused of it is guilty of it, you're not going to get a conviction. And it's the same thing with a UFO story, regardless of the nature of that particular story. If you have just one person's account and there is absolutely no other evidence to back it up, you have one person's account with no evidence.
You might want to ask Dr. David Viscott about... I understand what you're saying, but you might want to just ask Dr. David Viscott about this particular person, because he's not your average person. He's quite unique.
He's absolutely nothing. If Albert Einstein, if he were alive today, came in front of me and said, this is what I experienced, I would have the same reaction. That's a very interesting story. It may well be true. It's certainly something that bears recording. But as an investigator, there is absolutely nothing I can do with it.
With the exception of the fact that a person like that could be used in the potential identifying of these people.
Well, only if his identification matched somebody else's identification who was there at the same time or experienced the same thing. Then you've got a corroborated story and there's something you can do with it.
That's correct.
And in that case, I get real interested real fast.
I mention it because a friend was with this person, was with him, okay, at this particular incident at some diner in New Mexico and pointed the person out to him. And he went up to this person and took a seat a few stools away from him and looked him in the eye and had this this encounter that he refers to. And because of Dr. Tanius's background, I just thought it might interest you, and that's the only reason I mentioned
it. There was another person present, in other words.
Yes, there was. In fact, this person asked him to go down to New Mexico to investigate because of the strangeness of the people that were there at the time. And this is why he did this. It was at a particular diner, and he mentions it in his book.
Well, I'm going to have to get the copy of that book.
Yeah, I think I'll have to look that up, too.
And find out more about it. And I'll talk with David about it. I sure will.
All right.
Appreciate you getting in here and kind of filling us in on that. That's one show that I don't know what went on.
Okay.
No, I'm not familiar with it either, but I think I'll see what I can find out.
Okay.
You're very welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm Bill Jenkins. Bill Moore and I will be back in just a moment. All right, Craig?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, there you are.
All right. Well, I guess you could say we're having a double bill tonight.
Oh, hello there, Craig. Craig from way up in Mariposa or someplace, huh?
Right, you got it. Bill Moore, first I want to thank you for clarifying your position on the Philadelphia experiment. I think there must have been a lot of people that were a little uncertain where you came out on that. And I really want to get some more meat on the documents that you made public tonight. First of all, did I understand you to say earlier that this was released uncensored?
Yes, it was.
In that case, does that mean that the investigators were actually identified?
You got me on that, and I'll have to look at it and see.
But the reason I ask is, if they were, does that mean that their qualifications, et cetera, were also identified?
He's going through it here right now.
I'm looking to see if they are identified.
It's many pages.
It's quite lengthy.
How many pages is it?
It looks to me about, what, 10, 12?
16.
16?
Mm-hmm.
Photographs, too?
Photographs, drawings, the whole bit. No, it does not list the names of the individuals who prepared the report. It simply lists the office. And it states Directorate of Intelligence Headquarters, U.S. Air Force, Office of Naval Intelligence, Navy Department. And that's as far as it goes.
Do we know anything else about that directorate?
Well, certainly that they existed and still do. There is still an Air Force intelligence arm.
Oh, yeah, I understand that. So it doesn't identify any further who conducted the investigation. In other words, it seems that you're assuming that there was a unit set up within the directorate that did the investigation?
Well, it's clear from the document that that's
uh-huh.
what happened.
Uh-huh.
It says here, summary and conclusions, problem. One, to examine pattern of tactics of flying saucers, hereinafter referred to as flying objects, and to develop conclusions as to the possibility of existence. And then it goes into a facts and discussion section and an analysis section and whatnot and so forth.
Uh-huh. Is there anything that specifically would point to this being a unit that would continue in existence after this particular investigation was completed?
It leaves that possibility open, and I think one could assume that without the evidence that the unit involved must have done either previous or subsequent work.
All right. But they don't give it like a project name in the document?
No. Hmm. No, they're just a number.
That brings up another question. How did you... I know all these documents have a document locator number. How did you come up with that kind of information?
Well, to make a long story short, without going into a lot of detail, it's going to bore a lot of people
right.
because it's numbers and whatnot and so forth. I guess I'm one of the very few researchers, UFO researchers, who has spent considerable time in the National Archives, in the presidential libraries and whatnot around the country, and have learned the system, have learned the kind of materials they have, come to know some of the people who are involved in the custody of these things. And
I'm going to have to break in here right now. Do you want to hang on, Craig?
Sure.
So we can do this so it doesn't get all jammed up a little bit later, all right?
Go ahead.
We've got just a couple of more things to do. I know you were in the middle of something when I broke it up there.
Right. Bill was explaining how he was able to locate the document.
Yeah, it has to do with the familiarity of the system and where they've got certain things stored and what their numbering systems are and so forth and so on. And once you know or begin to learn how they do things, you can begin to track down where things might be.
How did you know this was this particular document was worth pursuing to this extent?
We didn't. What we knew was that there was a box of stuff which appeared to have some stuff in it that we thought might be interesting.
So you basically hit it lucky.
No, I wouldn't say that at all. I think that it was an educated guess.
I don't mean to, downplay your own input on it.
Yeah, and there were some other researchers that were involved in finding this material as well. We weren't the only ones. It was sort of a joint effort on the part of myself and several others.
Okay, Greg, does that help you?
Well, last question then. Since it's been released, how is this being made available to the public?
At this point, it's not, but I intend to offer it as a publication. If people write to me, why, we do have it.
Okay. Well, what's your address?
Okay, let's give the address again. Very good.
Give the Dewey address, because we're running real short.
Okay. Easiest way to get to me without a pencil and paper in hand is to write to Bill Moore, Dewey, Arizona, 86327. And if you forget the zip code, just put Dewey, Arizona, and I'll get it.
Okay.
Do it anyway. Craig, thank you very much.
Okay, Bill, thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
You know, every year on Mother's Day...
Thank you so very, very much. I want to recommend your monthly newsletter, Focus.
Yes, the Fair Witness Project, Focus.
And your list of goodies that they can get by...
About 100 different items, research materials, books, publications, and whatnot, right to Bill Moore, Dewey, Arizona.
That'll
I'll get it.
And you're lecturing in San Francisco, or in San Francisco
Fremont,
area?
California, at the John F. Kennedy High School in Fremont on May the 25th at 7:30 p.m.
All right. That's nothing in the Los Angeles area for the present time.
Possibly in the early fall.
Well, let us know
sure will.
When that happens. And congratulations and thank you for the long hours of study you put in on this program that you are involved in.
Well, I do it just for you, Bill.
Well, I didn't mean this program. The program of getting the information out that there is something to the UFO. It isn't all just a lot of people having fancy notions.
You know, Bill, I get the information. It's people like you that get it out.
And I love
it. Without programs like this, it couldn't be done.
Thank you very much for dropping by. Next week, we'll have a psychic fair. That'll be fun, so you join me then.
Happy celebration 25.